Hey folks, today we're sharing an episode from True Crime News, a podcast that dives deep into shocking real-life cases and the investigations that follow. In this episode, the team explores a horrifying crime that highlights the darkest corners of human behavior. A man is accused of killing his pregnant older sister and later telling investigators he believes she was, quote-unquote, no longer innocent. What led to such a brutal act, and how did authorities piece together the truth? If you're interested in true crime reporting that goes beyond the headlines, take a listen to this episode, and be sure to subscribe to True Crime News, the podcast, for more episodes uncovering the stories behind some of today's most disturbing headlines.
A word of warning, this podcast explores graphic and disturbing stories and includes some strong language. It therefore may not be suitable for our young listeners or other folks who may find it disturbing.
Hello and welcome to True Crime News, the podcast covering high-profile and under-the-radar cases from across the country every week. I'm your host, Anna Garcia. Our case this week, the FBI describes it as one of the rarest forms of murder. When a brother kills a sister, this type of homicide occurs for about 1 to 3% of all murders. So why did a 24-year-old man kill his pregnant 30-year-old sister? Prosecutors say they found the brother's journal, where he wrote that his married sister, who was expecting her first child, was impure. He invited her over for dinner, and then he chopped up her body. And the person who found her dead was their mother. That woman now has lost her daughter, her grandchild, and her son will likely be locked up for the rest of his life. We're recording this on Friday, January 30th of 2026. Our guest today is Dr. Tracy Tambora, a professor of criminal justice at the University of New Haven in Connecticut. She is an expert in the field of domestic violence and a dear friend of the show. Tracy, welcome back. It is so good to see you.
Good to see you too. Happy 2026.
I can't believe it's 2026,
2026,
right?
Yes, it's already.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. And we start the year with so much violence, so much mm-hmm. violence. And this case, the reason I really wanted to examine this case is because of your expertise in domestic violence, but we're looking at a different dynamic. We're looking at siblings, mm-hmm. which we don't often see. And they're, you know, the defense is claiming that the now admitted killer is suffering from mental illness.
Sure.
So I don't know what your thoughts are, and we're going to get into the detail, but of just, again, how very little we see this sibling kind of killing, sure. especially when it's not like over money or an estate.
Sure. So 2 points. One is a definitional issue. So I'm not sure I could classify it as domestic violence. I would probably call it family violence. So in most states, domestic violence requires that there's some form of cohabitation. So again, I don't know if they were living together. At some point, I'm sure they were living together, but it is definitely, we don't have to get caught up on semantics. It's definitely family violence. Point number two is very well taken. This is a very seldom documented form of family violence, or we can say domestic violence broadly, because we see only about 200 to 300 cases per year of all types of offender victim murder in which the offender and victim are well acquainted or related. So yeah, it is a lesser known, but we do know that family violence includes sibling violence, including we have research on sibling child abuse, sibling incest, unfortunately. So it is not an unexpected form, but the fact that there is a homicide makes it statistically less probable.
Mm. All right. So this case is out of Lakeville, Minnesota. The accused here is 24-year-old Jack Ball, and he's pleaded guilty to 2 counts of murder. Premeditated first-degree murder of his older sister, 30-year-old Bethany Israel, and premeditated first-degree murder of her unborn child. This happened in May of 2024. Bethany was reportedly carrying a baby boy whom they had named Levi. Very, very tragic.
Very tragic, very sad. And as you said, it's sad for not just the community, but also the mother who found her, or who found the scene, and who in one day loses the major part of her family, her daughter, grandchild to be, and her son, who will inevitably end up in the criminal justice system for the rest of his life, one way or another.
Yeah, I don't know how you reconcile that. I don't know how you as a parent and the rest of the family can deal with the loss of two lives, and then knowing that it's at the hands of another family member. We often see this as parent and child, and we see how children sometimes stand by their parents. This one's complicated because the relationships are radically different than parent and child.
It is, right. It is.
So it is said, and I almost feel like there's just a little bit of motive in this.
Mm-hmm.
It is said, based on what was written in her obituary, and you know, as she was given grace and praise by those missing her, that Bethany was the favorite child of Mark and Judy Ball. And sibling rivalry is one of those motives when it comes to sibling violence, right?
Sure. Definitely. Yeah, that's circled on my paper when I read that. I did my homework. Circle.
I know. I know, professor.
Yes, I did. I'm an A student. Yeah, sibling rivalry. I mean, we'll unpack this a little. There's so many layers, right? There's the potential sibling rivalry, the fact that he's very young, 24 years old, the crime is so horrific, also is going to raise some red flags around mental health, which of course the prosecutors are confronting right now. And then finally, you have his concept and his own words, she wasn't pure. So we're also looking at another dimension, which is, you know, rooted in violence against women, these preconceived notions about female purity, chastity, et cetera. So there's a bunch of layers here to unpack.
There really are. And we are missing a lot of details. And mm-hmm. that's entirely possible because there's been a plea in this. However, the case doesn't end there because the defense is claiming mental illness. And therefore, in the state of Minnesota, you can actually make an argument that you are not criminally mm-hmm. responsible for the murder if you were not mentally well at the time, which really complicates things. So I have a feeling that when the next hearing comes, which will have to do with what the sentence will be and his mental fitness will be a part of this broader discussion, we may then learn more details. So far, a lot of what was going on in the family and whether there was a history of mental illness with Jack, we don't have all those details, but we do have enough here to have a discussion. And again, it's the level of violence here, and it's the violence against a pregnant woman. Mm-hmm. This is horrific. So, according to her obituary, Bethany had a lifelong love of music, and she played the flute, and she loved volleyball. In fact, it was on the volleyball court that she met her soon-to-be husband, Joseph Israel. The pair married on April 30th of 2021, so they hadn't been married that long. They eloped to Jamaica, and the couple was ready to start a family. And Bethany was about 4 months pregnant when she was murdered. Bethany also obviously not only loved children because she was going to be a mother, but she also was a school teacher. So
mm-hmm.
this is, you know, her entire world was about children. It's really unclear what was going on between the brother and the sister. You know, obviously, I'm guessing at the very minimum, there was some serious tension here because I read things and it's just, you know, your gut telling you the fact that Bethany had been invited over to Jack's house for dinner.
Yeah.
Jack invited her for dinner. And then when no one heard from her, this is the part. She went over around 6 p.m. on May 23rd of 2024.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And so as a parent, you'd be so thrilled that your kids are having dinner, right?
Sure.
That makes you so happy. But then when no one hears from Bethany and Bethany doesn't come home and it's 11 o'clock, there's a panic in the family, and the mother drives over to Jack's house. Now, here's the thing. Under normal circumstances, if you knew that your adult kids were safely having dinner together,
sure,
you probably wouldn't worry, would you?
Sure. I mean, those particular details, I wish we could unpack more. I wish we could get more information. Because on the one hand, you have Bethany, who seems to accept an invitation to her brother's house. She goes. We don't yet know if that was something that happened on a regular basis, if it raised a red flag for the husband or the mother, but she goes. And then at some point, she's not responding to phone calls. So again, this is the part, right? As a criminologist who's reviewed cases, I've seen things that are easily explained and I've seen things that make no sense, right? It's 11 o'clock. She was tired. She told her husband, imagine a scenario. She tells her husband, hey, I'll be home by 8 because I am exhausted. And then she's not home. The husband calls, are you okay? I just want to make sure you're not driving tired. So it doesn't raise a red flag for the family. But you could imagine another scenario. And in that first case, they're just calling because they know she's pregnant, tired, and it's not like her not to communicate. In the second scenario, mom has concerns because she has noticed odd behavior with her son. And she, when maybe the husband calls her and says, hey, have you heard from Bethany? I haven't. Mom calls Bethany, calls Jack, the son. No one is responding. And mom's like, let me see what's going on. But again, you could have a personal, a perfectly reasonable explanation that doesn't raise red flags, or we could. I think that's why all of us are so interested in crime, because there's 100 scenarios that we could each run through our head to try to explain the circumstances that took place in that 2 to 3 hours.
Yeah, absolutely. And you're right. It was early. I mean, if she went over at 6, I know for me, I'm like, okay, 8:30, I got to go home now. I probably would not be out until 11. However, they are younger, and if... let's say they're hashing something out. I don't know. I'm just speculating here. If they're hashing something out or they're getting to the bottom of maybe some tension or anything like that, you can imagine those family conversations can go on forever. But you're right. The fact that she's not responding and it's the mother that drives over.
Yeah, it's not the husband. It's the mother that drives over.
Yes. So I think something was going on there. I don't think that Jack just woke up and... as his defense team says that he's mentally ill. I don't think that morning he's just like, okay, and today I am about to commit a murder. There were journals. This is not something that manifested. Plus, yeah. I don't think these things just manifest overnight. So, and we've only been given a little bit of what's in those journals. I think there's a lot more. And the fact that he already has entered his plea of guilty.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
I mean, one of the things that right away is always a red flag for me when I'm looking at cases in which there's a young man is this age. I don't know, I'm not a psychiatrist or a psychologist, but it's pretty well known in the social science academic community that somewhere between 18 and 25, 26, the Axis I mental health disorders start to kick in. These are some serious issues like a clinical bipolar or a schizophrenia. These are things that start to take a toll not only on your mental health, but your physical health. So again, it's just for me a variable that I need to consider. It's not an excuse, a justification, but it's something that in the back of my mind, I'd like more information. His age, the heinous nature of the crime. If I had to put money or my credentials on it, I would say there is something mental health going on. I don't know if it reaches the level in which you can excuse culpability legally, but there are some variables that need to explore because there could very well be a mental health deterioration occurring at this time.
Yeah, absolutely. So Bethany's mother told police
there once was a woman who lived in a shoe, a size too snug, but what could she do? But that's not where her story ends. Thanks to a little help from her Experian friends, she got her score into much better shape and relocated to a box-fresh new place with room to grow and a mortgage to suit. Now, she lives in a spacious 4-bedroom cowboy boot. Better your Experian credit score to help get mortgage ready. Experian. Better your score. Better your story.
that as soon as she arrived, she saw Jack tearing out in his car.
Right.
Not a good sign, probably. Mm-mm. Not a good sign. And that when Mom walked into Jack's house, it was a bloodbath. Mm-hmm. The mother called 911. It was about 11 p.m. And according to the criminal complaint, police found a large pool of blood on the kitchen floor. It was all over the kitchen cabinets, and it was seeping under the sink. Police found body parts throughout the house. They also found the bloody tools that were used to chop up this pregnant woman, to kill her and her mm-hmm. baby. There were bloody knives, a saw, a hatchet mm-hmm. near the stairway to the second floor. Police officers say they found several of Bethany's dismembered body parts.
Yeah.
I mean, this is, and we're not even done, because the crime scene extends beyond. He took other parts of his sister, sister's body, took them with him. Police say they get as they're trying to figure out what is going on in Jack's house, they get another 911 call saying that a resident says on their Ring doorbell, a man has delivered a bloody body part to their front door.
Yeah.
So
these are going to be elements of the crime that will support, I don't know successfully, but will support the defense attorney's claim that he is not mentally well. Again, this is the hard part, right? Like, perfectly sane people can dismember a body.
Yes.
Even the body of somebody very close to them. And so trying to determine his sanity, his state of mind in that moment is going to require a lot of reflection. The other thing, I don't know if we want to go there yet or we want to keep reviewing the scene, but I'm always struck by how the general population assumes it's really easy to claim insanity and then you get off scot-free. Do you want to go there now? Do you want to have that conversation?
We can. I mean, we can certainly touch on it. I think we'll talk on it when we look at the phase of what's next, but it's lots of people claim insanity. It is, it's a defense move.
Sure.
And I think what infuriates people
sure.
is how many people claim insanity to get sure. off.
Sure.
And yes. really aren't. And so right. the level that it takes to prove to a court
yes.
that someone really was incompetent that is a very hard threshold.
Less than 1%, yeah.
Less than 1%, wow.
Yeah, you can claim insanity, and many people do. But to be able to use insanity in the court is very limited, number one. But number two, it's actually not in your best interest. Because if you are able to prove insanity at time of committing a crime, then you are held in some sort of legal limbo. So you're doesn't mean you go out on the street. It means you are remanded to a criminal mental health facility for an indeterminate sentence. So often if you would have not pled insanity, and okay, this is a heinous crime, we have the murder of a woman and the murder of an unborn child, you're probably up for life anyway. But if you claimed insanity on a less horrific murder involving less salacious details, maybe you're getting 15 to 20. But if you are able to prove insanity, you may be in a facility for 50 to 70 years the rest of your life. So I think the general public, yes, many people claim insanity defense, but the process you have to go through, the judge requires you go through to be able to use the insanity defense is lengthy and it's improbable. Again, I think it's about 1% or less that you can actually use it as the defense. And then you're going away probably the rest of your life. It's an indeterminate sentence.
Although we have seen
yes.
Yes, here's and this is the part that also infuriates people, especially with the abuse of the insanity defense, is we've seen people go to a psychiatric facility, a prison version of it. Then they're deemed competent. They've been in there a long enough time. Then they're deemed not a threat to society, and they get released.
Yes. It's very rare, and the media loves these cases.
Yes.
So then we think it's much more common than it is. But the other thing that can happen if you're pleading insanity, the judge needs to make a determination. Are you in, is your competency in question at point of crime, or is your competency in question right now? Mm. Because there's competency to stand trial. And so if drugs or some sort of therapeutic process can get you competence to stand trial, then even if it is you came in seemingly insane, if they can make you competent, sane enough, then you can still stand for criminal trial. The problem is in this case, they're saying at time of offense, he didn't possess mens rea, guilty mind. Mm-hmm. He was too insane to know the that his actions were illegal, immoral. Like that's, he's going to have a harder time with that. Not impossible, but he's going to have a pretty hard time because he did leave the scene. Usually when people are insane at the scene, they stay there. The police come and they're like, yeah, I did this, but what's the problem? Right. So this is a complex case, and we're going to need many more details from the forensic report. Mm-hmm. To understand what his state of mind was, both in the moment of the murder and then leading up to the trial.
And this to me is fascinating because the police say when they found him covered in blood.
Sure.
They asked him the date.
Yes, right.
They asked him who the president was.
Right.
And so he was able, even though he was covered in blood, and he had actually tried to harm himself and had cut his neck. So it was his blood, Bethany's blood. The man's a mess. But he's able to tell the police some information that is clear about his ability to perceive where he is and what the day is.
Sure. And again, this is what the prosecutors are going to need to bring in expert testimony, because you might be intellectually cognitive, but you could still be insane and vice versa. So this is where you're going to need expert testimony to evaluate him.
I do find this interesting when the police ask the mother, where could he have gone? This is before the call comes in about the bloody part at the door, just a random house. Sure. She told officers that he may have gone to a nearby cemetery in Rosemont where family members were buried. Mm. And I just think that's it's extremely specific. When I think of places to run after a murder.
Well, that's why you're not a murderer, though.
Oh. Well, thank you, Tracy.
Yes. I say that with all my expert credentials behind me. You don't appear to be a murderer.
It's like, why would you go to a cemetery?
I don't know. Right. Yeah. Again, these are things we need to understand about him. Has he been rapidly developing a severe and acute mental health issue over the last few years? If so, then his decision to go to a place that's a bit macabre, morose, fits in, lines up. Does he have an infatuation with death? I mean, he seems to have a, proclivity to murder in a heinous way. So, these again, for me, they're variables that we need to explore, but they don't necessarily point to culpability. They do, if we're going to use a really technical criminological term, they are more telling of creepiness.
Yes. Yes. And in this creepiness, it's also entirely possible if he's ever disappeared or when things got tense, if this was where he was going, there's a reason the mother said the cemetery. Because someone would ask my loved one or your loved one, where would she have run? And, you know, you'd really have to think of comfort, familiarity, and sure. places you've been before. Sure. But that, again, there are little pieces of a puzzle yeah. here. We can't fill it all in, but it is certainly telling us a story about what was going on here.
Definitely.
So
yeah.
let's get back to Jack and the body parts that he's carrying around his sister. So that 911 call comes in and police go straight to that house. And then they say that they find Jack's car. And then they finally find Jack, again, right. covered in blood with a slash around his neck. But police said that he was still coherent. He was able to communicate, police said, clearly with them.
Sure.
They said in the police report and in the criminal complaint that he seemed competent at the time.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's interesting. I mean, again, he knew the date, the time,
yeah.
and the current president. Mm-hmm. Police say they also found additional pieces of his sister, Bethany, at different locations. It was multiple locations where they found this poor woman.
Yeah.
So now let's get to the other incriminating evidence. So now we have the bloody scene at Jack's house. Jack is a mess, obviously. DNA is going to tell a story there. Then there are the body parts at various locations. The fact that Jack is taken off. They find his journals, police say, and in the criminal complaint, they say that Jack has written some troubling details. They don't release all of them, but the police say that he expressed anger against his sister for being pregnant.
Mm-hmm.
And he allegedly wrote that Bethany was no longer innocent.
Mm-hmm.
Now, okay. Here's my logical problem with this. Your sister married a few years ago, okay?
Sure.
She's older than you.
Sure.
So I'm sorry, but she's married. So where's this innocence part coming? And now we're talking about a baby, which is, you know, this is a blessing.
Right.
So again,
It does present a bit of a quandary, right? Because if you had somebody who, there are schizophrenics or there are very mentally ill people who are obsessed with strict interpretation of religious law. And so, but this would seem contradictory, right? Because you would think if somebody was obsessed with some sort of traditional religious doctrines in which women are no longer innocent once, you know, the male touch has been placed upon them, you probably wouldn't kill the baby. So that's quite interesting. The other part that's interesting for me as somebody who worked in the field, victims of domestic violence, sexual assault, and my area of expertise is not just domestic violence, sexual assault, but the concept of violence against women. It really is fascinating to me because this almost signals some sort of antiquated, I thought long gone mentality about the notion of female innocence and purity. Every so often a case like this will arise, which tells me, you know, we're not that far away from having these traditionally antiquated notions of the female body. Again, though, we have a problem because she's married. So most individuals who accept these very antiquated notions of the female purity and sanctity think that that is that once the there is a true and valid marriage, then it is sexual contact between male and female is permissible. There was one little part that made me wonder, though. Do you remember the part of the story, the part of the information in which she elopes to Jamaica to get married?
Yes.
So what if it, again, I'm just looking at variables. What if this is somebody who has a form of mental illness that really concentrates on this religiosity?
Mm.
And she wasn't married in some sort of a church setting. Again, I'm grasping here, but that those two things juxtapose each other did make me say, this is strange, because he doesn't accept the sanctity of her marital union. He still calls her words like not innocent and unpure, which strange. And then the final one that it makes me think about again, I mean, at least in this country, we should be 150 years away from honor killings.
We should be, right?
We should be, right? And so you have this brother who there is some notion of honor killing here in his rationale is she's not pure, she's not innocent. I'm her brother. I need to remedy this. So there's just some like socio-political and historic layers here for me that are really interesting. This isn't a typical killing, so I'm not saying, oh, honor killings are going to come back. We're moving to a new era. Although I see more notions and questioning of women's purity in social media now than I did maybe 15 or 20 years ago, I don't think it's going to resurface to the point that this kind of case is going to be common. But I do think it's interesting to note that there is more chatter in social media about the role of women in a more traditional way than I've seen in a long time. I'd like to watch it.
Do you find it interesting that she's the older sister? I almost feel like if she had been the younger sister, some of this might have made, please, and I'm using this term loosely, might have made sense, because none of this makes sense.
And here
we are trying to, look, I don't know what his mental state was, but this entire thing, this is lunacy. This is craziness. So trying to unravel and apply logic to his reasoning is, I understand people, ridiculous. Right.
Right.
I get that. But we are trying to understand what happened to this woman and to this baby, and trying to understand how this fits in and what justice is going to look like as we examine these cases.
Yeah, no, again, I think I hear where you're going with that. Would it have been more rational? And again, I'm using words that don't quite apply to this case. Would it have made more sense if she was the younger sister and he thought, you know, the family was offended and he needed to remedy this? Or, you know, you could also argue the other way, that it was his older sister. She was always there for him. Now she's having a baby that's going to replace
him. Mother complex. This is where I'm going.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right. So he's going to lose.
He's jealous on a whole other level.
Yes. He right. Could this be? Sure. Yeah.
There's a lot going on here. There is a lot going on here. And it's just, this whole thing is just, it's just so horrendous. In fact, Bethany's body was in such terrible shape, meaning the way it was pulled apart, destroyed, and tossed all over town, that the medical examiners had a hard time pinpointing the exact cause of death. And we don't see that a lot. Usually we get a pretty good indication. So the cause of death has been listed as, quote, complex homicidal violence. And they noted that she was between 17 and 18 weeks pregnant.
Yeah, so the medical examiner cannot say blunt force trauma to the head. The medical examiner cannot say strangulation, right? The state of the body is such that the actual cause of death, was it the severing of the femoral artery? Was it the severing of the, you know, arteries in the neck? Was it a puncture to the heart? I mean, the medical examiner can't even begin to unpack that. And so the medical examiner is using this very generic label.
Which really means we have to really think carefully when we try and have the compassion for Bethany and her baby, what this woman was put through by her own brother.
Sure.
He admitted to it. This is beyond. This is beyond. And again, that poor mother walking into this, seeing her baby daughter, the grandchild, and then knowing that her son is responsible for this. I don't even know how you wake up in the morning. I don't even know. So after his arrest, Jack's indicted on 2 counts of premeditated first-degree murder and 2 counts of intentional second-degree murder. During his first court appearance, he appeared via video conferencing from the hospital. His bail was set at $1 million with conditions, $2 million without conditions. The fact that anyone would have considered bail without conditions. And I realized it was at $2 million and he wasn't going to reach it. Why even put that on the table? I'm sorry. Nothing. Man cannot be released. Cannot be released. So I don't know what was going on there. So once Jack was medically cleared, he returned back to the custody of the Dakota County Jail. Mm-hmm. Now, Jack's defense attorney told prosecutors and the judge that Jack suffers from mental illness. But prosecutors at this point were like, whatever, we're moving forward mm-hmm. with this case. On January 21st this mm-hmm. year, not too long ago, prosecutors announced that Jack had pleaded guilty to counts of 1 and 3 in the indictment. So basically, Jack has accepted responsibility for 1 count of premeditated first-degree murder and 1 count of premeditated first-degree murder of an unborn child.
Correct.
So we would think in this case, we are looking perhaps at swifter justice, that the family will be spared the pictures, the body cam, everything, whatever Jack was saying at the scene covered in his sister's blood and his blood. But we're really not. We're really not being spared here, because now the matter, and it is his right, and his defense attorney's right, they've thrown, I'm going to call it a wrench, but it's, you know, an absolute permitted legal move that in the state of Minnesota, a person cannot be held criminally responsible if mental illness prevented them from understanding their actions or the difference between right and wrong at the time of the offense. So that's what they're claiming. And now, you know, generally a judge will decide what the sentence will be. But there's going to have to be a hearing. It is about sentencing, but it's also about his mental health in order to understand how to proceed with sentencing. It's what I'm saying is there's another layer. It's complicated. It's a move, you know, maybe to get not Jack, not to have him completely get off, but.
No, it appears that he pled guilty. Right.
Yeah, he definitely is. He has entered his guilty plea to two murders. So that he is done.
Right. So he is convicted of murder. What is happening now is there is a second phase. I don't know if Minnesota uses a bifurcated trial phase or it is the sentencing phase. What's happening now? His guilt is not in question. He's guilty of the two indictments. He's guilty of the two counts.
But he can always, you know, I've seen this before. He can take back that plea.
He could take back. He can take back the plea up into a point, but it appears here that what is being contested is the punishment. And so what Jack is saying under Minnesota law, I don't want to be held criminally responsible in terms of incarceration in a penitentiary.
Oh, yeah, I wouldn't want. Yeah, right. Because Jack doesn't want to be held responsible for his actions. Oh, that's right. Mm-hmm.
Sure.
Yeah.
But it doesn't mean that Jack is going to be walking free among us.
Correct.
He may be institutionalized for the rest of his life.
But here's, I think, what the next move is going to be. So at some point, Jack's going to realize things didn't go his way, right? And I'm a bitter man now. And I'm scribbling away in my journals all crazy. And now I'm going to tell the legal system, you know what? When I entered that plea, I was crazy. I didn't know what I was doing. I'm sorry, but I just...
Listen, you and I are no fan of Jack. I get that.
No.
Jack, you know, we're not having Jack for dinner, regardless of what happens. Jack did a horrendous thing in which the lives of an entire family are devastated.
Oh, my God, I can't. This poor family. And this is and you know, think about it. You're the parents. You've lost your daughter, your grandchild. Your son's accused.
Your husband.
The husband. Oh my God.
He's lost his child
right.
and his wife. Yeah.
And then, you know, you're dealing with whatever it is that Jack is going to try and do to defend himself. We're not saying he's going to get away with this, but I have seen this before where you enter a plea, then all of a sudden you're taking your plea back because it's not working the way you think it was going to. And because he's, you know, his defense is claiming mental instability, there's the potential here to make a claim that, oh, well, I couldn't have entered that plea in my right mind. You know, I can, and every move in his defense, I hope I'm saying this right, is almost another injury to the family as they get like emotional whiplash of what's happening now with Jack's case. Because it's not like they can just push Jack away completely, especially since they are witnesses and they are victims and they get, you know, survivor and victim impacts. So do you see what I'm saying? At every move that Jack makes in his own defense is another insult and another injury to this family.
Yes.
And that's the part. It's that additional pain. And I know, I mean, you can think like, how can you inflict any more pain? But it's just like, just makes that wound just more raw. And that's what upsets me about all this.
Yeah. And I mean, we have a myriad of outcomes, right? Jack accepts the plea and he attempts to use mental illness to prevent him from being incarcerated in a penitentiary. It doesn't work. He gets life in prison, in a prison. Okay. He gets life in a prison. Number two, it works, but now he has life in a state-run forensic institution, which is very similar to a prison.
Yeah.
Or number three, there's probably five now that I'm going through this. No, Jack says, oh, no, I want to rescind the plea. If I was his defense attorney, I'd say, don't do it, Jack. It's clear you killed her. A, we've got the evidence. And B, you already gave testimony to this. And then they go after another sentence because a lot of times judges and prosecutors do not like it when you enter a plea. In fact, in particular, if you enter a plea to try to lessen the burden on the family that's left, and then you rescind that plea, okay, they're going to go after, the prosecutor is going to go after the charge and the punishment without any mercy or without any consideration for Jack's mental state. I mean, there's a lot of options that could happen. Unfortunately, Anna, you and I talk all the time. The option that is not on the table is absolute justice. There is no such thing. We are not going to get an outcome that makes us feel happy about this situation. A woman and her unborn child are dead. A family is affected. You may or may not have a very mentally ill man who may or may not also be rattled with guilt. I don't know. It's just you have a husband who's lost his wife and child, right? This is a mess. And I know people like me and you who study crime victimization for a living, we have to accept there's no such thing as absolute justice. Right. There are better case scenarios and there are worse case scenarios, but none of us are going to be happy by the outcome of this case.
No, this is a huge tragedy. This is a huge tragedy for Bethany, her family, the new family that she was starting. It's a massive loss. So this new hearing to figure out what happens next with Jack and his mental state is going to be, it's scheduled now for May 21st. Mm-hmm. So we are going to follow this case. And those of you who know when I say that, I really mean it. We do follow and update cases. Until then, and I think this is interesting, he remains behind bars at the Dakota County Jail.
Mm-hmm.
Not in a psychiatric facility or hospitalized. So I just have prayers for Bethany and baby Levi.
Another party invite? Well, here's a way to make their big day feel even more special. With small shops on Etsy, you can discover thousands of original birthday presents. Like a handmade leather camera strap to celebrate your photography-obsessed friend, or maybe a custom top for that Pisces in your life. From the personalized to the practical, we've got you covered with millions of active listings to choose from. Birthdays don't celebrate themselves. Shop at Etsy.com and discover your perfect find today.
What I've dedicated my life to is revenge.
A brand new drama based on the best-selling novel.
They think they're better than us.
Who do you think you are?
I'm going to prove to them that they're wrong.
She's punishing me.
You destroyed my family. I will not rest until I've destroyed yours.
A Woman of Substance on Channel 4. Stream now.
McDonald's cards are here. 24 cards to find and free food in every pack. Enter cards in the McDonald's app and complete sets with over £4 million in cash prizes to be won. McDonald's cards. 18 plus UK only with selected meals subject to availability. Ends 27th of April. App may be required. See mcdrules.co.uk.
We all love a good meal, but there's no feeling quite like cooking one. Whether it's everyone at yours for a Sunday roast or after school sausage and mash. Quick, simple, gone in minutes. One thing brings it all together. Ah, Bisto. The original gravy. Rich, smooth, and unmistakable since 1908. When the gravy makes the dish, make the gravy. Ah, Bisto.
It is time for our comment section. These are the crime cases that you all are talking about on social media. And here is our producer, Will Updike. Hey, Will, how are you?
Good. How's it going?
Good, thanks.
So we have another complicated sort of family case. This one involves like a major mix-up. This one comes out of Orange County, Florida, where a couple has recently filed a lawsuit alleging that a fertility clinic mixed up embryos leading to leading to the birth of a baby that wasn't biologically there. So I kind of want to get into this. And one, I was really interested what people would think in the comments sort of about how to unfold this whole situation, because it is very, very, you know, it is very bizarre. It is very complicated. But according to Orlando couple Tiffany Score and Stephen Mills, they began pursuing in vitro fertilization with IVF Life Inc. beginning in 2020. And the couple reportedly was able to fertilize three of Tiffany's embryos, and the eggs were kept in cryogenic storage for later usage. In 2025, the couple, you know, felt ready to have a baby. They returned, and they were able to successfully implant one of those around April of last year. And miraculously, the couple gives birth to a happy, healthy female child. But something doesn't seem quite right. The child doesn't resemble them. Tiffany and Stephen are both racially Caucasian. The child immediately, like racially and physically, does not appear to be theirs. Now, despite this issue, you know, we've heard of things happening. You know, you hear of stories of couples, you know, giving birth, not even in IVF, and their child looking different. And even though this child like doesn't resemble them physically, the couple says they developed an intensely strong emotional bond with the child. You know, seems like we've got, you know, some good parents here, some people who are really hoping for the best outcome. And even though maybe things right away don't seem, you know, they seem like a different situation, it seems like they're still moving forward with this, you know, in an amicable way. However, around the beginning of this year, the couple began to worry that maybe they had been given the wrong embryo. And this starts to concern the parents because if the child wasn't theirs and it was someone else's,
where is their baby? Exactly.
They're thinking, their lawsuit says, and this is a direct quote, that the girl should legally and morally be united with her genetic parents so long as they are fit, able, and willing to take her. So the parents end up paying for DNA testing. And unfortunately, this child does bear no DNA resemblance to the parents, meaning the embryo, this is like the crazy part. Like, so meaning this embryo that they placed in Tiffany was not one of the ones that her and her husband produced, which opens up this whole other can of worms. Now, I do want to note here, because like we got some people who are sort of angry in the comments. I do want to note this couple isn't giving up on the baby. Like, they haven't done this to be like, you know, this isn't ours. We're done with the child. They're more than happy to keep the child. They've bonded with the child. However, they do have concerns about what happened to their embryos.
Absolutely.
And if they have other babies
it's
out there.
It's all reasonable. Sure. It's so complicated. Many emotions.
Yes. And again, like to bring it back to the parents, like the, you know, the people who produced this embryo, it not going to them, you know? So there's kind of like a whole sort of moral quandary there. Now, sure. The lawsuit, it doesn't mention anything about damages or anything like that. So I want to get that out of the gate too. They're seeking an explanation and testing, going back about 5 years to confirm you know, the biological parents of the child, and to see if any of their embryos are out there, you know, somewhere else in the ether. Now, the clinic has raised privacy concerns for other parents. They're saying that the patients would have to agree to be tested. However, a judge ordered the clinic to submit detailed plans on how it's addressing this situation. And according to the clinic, they are actively cooperating with an investigation to support one of our patients in determining the source of an error that resulted in the birth of a child who is not genetically related to them. And now, from what I was reading too, it's unclear how this mix-up could have happened. This could have happened back in 2020 when they initially gave the sample. You know, maybe something was mixed up then. It could have happened later when the embryo was placed around 2025. So there's a whole lot of issues going on there. But I do think that it seems like these parents aren't, you know, they're not like casting this baby aside or anything, which I do think is very, very important.
No, and you know, and the genetic testing is actually interesting because you might say, okay, well, they might have looked at the baby and said, oh, you know, we are racially such different such different backgrounds that it couldn't be mine. Not necessarily, because you have to factor this entire investigation was it possible that the baby was maybe half of theirs? You don't know what happened in this clinic, right? So first you have to figure out, is it possible that the baby is partly of the father, partly of the mother? Okay, now they've determined that there are no parts. So then this baby absolutely belongs to a different set of different biological parents. And then this raises the moral and legal question of what happened to their embryos? Were their embryos ever actually truly viable and made of both of their genetic material?
Yeah.
Was it mixed up? Was their genetic material mixed up with other people's and you have like now like four sets of babies? Or were the embryos implanted in another? I mean, the possibilities here are endless, and they absolutely have a right to an answer. And so, and that baby has a right to an answer. What about the baby's rights?
Yeah.
It also doesn't seem so complex, like privacy of the other people.
Oh, because please.
You already have the sperm and egg of all of these people. They voluntarily gave you the sperm and egg. So just start testing it until you come across one.
Yeah.
It might be costly, but I'm not buying their privacy thing because
you think this is BS. They don't want to admit to like
they don't
something.
Want to pay this agency. You already have everyone's DNA material. Just go through it, test it, and see where the match comes.
Yeah. Right.
The second part is like this poor couple, because I think like Anna said, like, you know, it's 2026 now. If mom's egg was harvested 6 years ago when she was in her early 30s, and now she has to go through this whole process again in her late 30s or early 40s, the viability of all this, I just think that this shady agency company doesn't want to deal with all the potential cost that could play out.
Well, and that's the thing too, right? Is like, you know, there's at a minimum two families and two children here. One would think, right? Like unless these embryos weren't viable.
It could be multiple.
Exactly. So I'm with Tracy here. I think that I think that it's not a privacy issue so much as like who knows how deep this whole thing could go. And then you have the deeper thing of so then what do you do? Like what do you do with all the like if there's a bunch of like mismatched donors and children and stuff?
Mm-hmm. That is just really something. And then the question will also be, was this an error? Or, I'm sorry, but we have seen people in the medical profession do very harmful things. So I have no idea. I am not putting any criminal blame anywhere because there are no criminal charges. But what if it's more than error? And what if it goes from error into a deliberate action, allegedly?
Yeah. Who knows? So we got kind of like a couple of camps in the comments. Nina H said the parents look like twins. We got a lot of comments about how similar the parents look. I'll show a picture for the video viewers. You know, they're both dark. They both have dark eyes, blonde hair, very similar looking couple. So I think it was like pretty apparent, you know, like that the baby was different genetically. But like we said, there's all sorts of things that can happen. You know, you hear about all sorts of stuff happening. Even siblings sometimes look so vastly different. Yeah. And then Aline W. said, poor, sweet, precious baby. I wish I could take her. We got a lot of people in the comments who were like, you know, they would keep the baby. They want the baby. There's a ton of people.
And she has rights. We can't forget that the baby has rights here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. But I do, like, again, I do want to bring it back to, like, I do. It does seem like the parents are handling this pretty amicably from their side. They just want information. They want answers, which, sure, you know, is not only for them, but for the benefit of the child as well.
How are they going to answer the child's obvious questions when she's able to say, you know, where did I come from? And they're going to be like, we really don't know.
Yeah, this is a real stork situation.
No idea where this baby came from. She has a right to know.
I'll close this one with a comment from another writer who I think wraps this all up well. They said, I don't think it's wrong to sue because it's definitely a major screw up, but I really hope they do right by the kiddo, which is sort of like the overwhelming thing, right? Like, we're just hoping for the best for the child in this scenario. But it does seem like something very wrong took place. And, you know, like, while the result is a human being and you love them, it seems like this family has bonded to them. They still deserve information and answers about how this occurred. And
also, let's not forget that this mother carried the child for 9 months.
I know. Yeah.
She served as some sort of de facto surrogate. I mean, that's, of course she's attached and connected to the child. Yeah.
Yeah.
How could you not be? Absolutely. No. Absolutely. Oh, wow. That's complicated.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'll be keeping an eye on this one. We'll see if we get any more updates on this. I mean, like I said, this could just be the start of, like, a very long rabbit hole. So who knows? But that will do it for this week's comment section. Anna, we're so happy that you're back. But I will see y'all next week.
Tracy, it is always such a pleasure to have you on. I always feel like I'm in a classroom. I'm in Dr. Tambora's class. And it's wonderful. It's just like you always explain things to us and you give us a different perspective. So I always look forward to when you're on. Where can people follow you and all that good stuff? Because I know you're working on your social media there.
I know. I do have Instagram now. So you can find me at Tracy, what do you say, dot Tambora?
Yes, if that's what it is. Yeah.
If you want to see my academic work, you can look at the University of New Haven's website. Thank you so much. And again, you know, I hope that your audience understands, as a victim advocate, I spent my first 9 years of my career in the field. But once I became an academic, you know, you spend 5 more years in school, you know, I have to be able to see both sides. Mm-hmm. And it in no way means that I'm excusing perpetrator behavior. It's just sometimes it's much more complex. But at the end of the day, Anna, what we always land on is, you know, victims deserve more justice than they're getting.
Always.
Yeah.
Always. I don't think we've ever found a case where there's been something like an absolute justice. There isn't, because you can't bring back what has been taken away.
Nope.
At all, at all, at all. But the conversation is always about what would justice look like and what, you know, and we do as a society have a voice, and we do have a voice when it comes to laws and electing prosecutors, DAs, all of that. So we have a say, although limited, in the process on what we in our community believe is right. And I think it's important to express these things and to have these conversations and to always remember the victims. And I think that's why I find you just so fascinating to talk to, because of your field experience plus the academics, and you put that together in a different package for us and explain things for us. And so it's greatly appreciated.
Thank you. Thank you.
You can find me at Anna G News, Anna with one N. You can find everything that we do here at True Crime News at My True Crime News. Kind of pretty simple there. You can subscribe to our YouTube page. You can also receive our newsletter at truecrimenews.com. So until next week, this is True Crime News, the podcast. I'm your host, Anna Garcia. Crime never stops, and neither do we.